I'd like to thank everybody for coming. This is the first annual Penrose Lecture in honor of Russell Penrose, who's a graduate of the University of Minnesota and spent most of his career in aerospace and has been a great friend to the university, the Institute of Technology, and the Department of Aerospace Engineering and Mechanics. And it's a real pleasure to have the first Penrose Lectureship given by our current Penrose professor, Dick James. Dick has been in the department since the mid-80s, roughly. He got his degrees at Brown University and Johns Hopkins University, and the last 20 years or so, he's become one of the leading researchers in solid mechanics and the mechanics of materials in the world. He's contributed to active materials, liquid crystals, paper folding, viruses, and many, many other fields. His work is characterized by rigorous mathematics, exceptional creativity, and an enormous amount of energy, enthusiasm, and optimism. And it's a real pleasure to have him here today to give us a talk on his newest research, which is on the structure of viruses. So, Dick.
Thank you, Perry. Thank you very much. I never worked on liquid crystals, Perry. So thank you very much, Perry, and I'm delighted to give this lecture. Hello, Russ. We're sorry that you couldn't be here, so this is being taped over here. So Russ will get the electronic version, and we all wish you a speedy recovery. So this talk is about structure. It's about the structure of viruses. And I have to say that the Penrose professorship enabled me to do research in this area, which cannot in any sense be considered part of aerospace engineering and mechanics, really, at least traditionally. It even can't be considered part of anything I know of. And it has links to viruses and structural mechanics, and it has links to Buckminster Fuller, a former professor at the University of Minnesota. And it was very much enabled by having the freedom that's and also enabled by the Russ Penrose professorship. So I also like to acknowledge some of this is joint work with Kaushik Dial, who's in the audience, and a postdoc with of myself and Ryan Elliott, and Trion Dimitrika and I worked. It's a very pleasant, had a very pleasant collaboration about this that's ongoing, and it began with work of Wayne Falk, who is a former PhD student, who worked on it, who did a thesis on a certain virus called bacteriophage T4. And I'd like to welcome a new student, Amartya Banerjee, who's beginning a thesis on this work. So the way that Wayne and I got started is by studying, as I said, the topic of his thesis, which is bacteriophage T4. And bacteriophages are viruses, and they're viruses that attack bacteria. That's why they're called bacteriophages. And they are everywhere. There are billions of them in this room. And in every cubic centimeter of seawater, there are 10 million bacteriophages. That's the clean seawater. So they're really everywhere. And this is one of the most interesting ones. It's quite a common one. And it's interesting because of the way it invades the cell. And this is what got us started about thinking about structure. And it's quite a complex virus. That's the so-called capsid that contains the DNA. This is the tail sheath. The whole assembly is the tail. That's the base plate. These are the tail fibers. There's short tail fibers here, not pictured very well. And this, as I said, this virus has its notoriety is because of the way it invades the bacterium. And this is a cryo-EM picture. Cryo-EM is a tremendous new technique for visualizing these viruses. This is the bacterium, and these are the T4s. So these are these guys. This one is still swollen with its DNA. This one has emptied out its DNA, and this one is about half emptied. And you can see the DNA going into the cell here. And the interesting thing about T4 is the way it actually enters the cell. And it does so the following way. So here's a schematic of a T4. There's, again, a cryo-EM picture, and you can see better the short-tail fibers and the long-tail fibers. But it floats around. It doesn't have any method of propulsion. In fact, it doesn't even have its own source of energy. No virus has its own source of energy, which is... So it's interesting to think about what I'm about to say from the point of view of where does the energy for this come from. In any case, an important role is played by this red part. That's the tail sheath. So that's what you see here. And what happens is it lands on the surface, and just due to random Brownian motion, and the short tail fibers stick to the surface of the cell. The long tail fibers are vibrating around because this is at small scales, and there are important entropic effects here. But eventually, one of the long tail fibers attaches, and eventually all of them attach. And they put a big moment on the base plate, which has the tendency of turning it inside out. That initiates a most unusual phase transformation, at least from a macroscopic viewpoint, in the tail sheath. And I've pictured here, this is results from theory, but you can also look at the experiments. There are ways to capture half-transformed sheaths in experiment too. It's just the pictures are not very clear, so I didn't put them here. But it looks very much like this. There's a wave of transformation that moves through, and it shortens that tail sheath by a factor of more than 2. And since the tail... Okay, so inside the tail sheath is a so-called tail tube. That's like a stiff needle, stiff hollow needle. And they're joined together at the top. So when the red part, the tail sheath, transforms like this, it drives the needle through the cell wall, and the DNA then enters the cell through the tube. So it's a kind of amazing method of entry of the cell. In fact, not only does it drive the needle through the cell wall, but it twists it a full turn during this process. It sticks in the knife, and it twists the knife a full turn, and then that's how it invades. And it's the structure of this tail sheath that got us thinking about the subject of this talk. So we had, as part of the work, we had to determine the structure. We had to somehow write a formula for the structure of the tail sheath. So I'll tell you how we did that. The first thing, we were fortunate that there's the tail sheath, and it actually has 6 times 23 molecules on the tail sheath, not so many. And what I'm going to show you is one of the molecules of the extended sheath, that's this one. And on the same picture, I'm going to show you one of the molecules of the contracted sheath. So in fact, there... So what you have to do is you have to picture that this z-axis, so that's right there, is coming out at you. So you think of XYZ coordinate system, and this is a slice through this molecule. So this is a slice through the molecule of contracted sheath and the same molecule of extended sheath. And then as you increase the Z and take more slices, you can see that you see more of the molecule, and then, of course, here it disappears. And from these pictures, you can see that the molecule has 3 domains. Actually, the molecule has about 10,000 atoms in it, and the structure of the molecule is not known. Very typical situation in biology is the sequence is precisely known, the structure of the molecule is not known. But these electron density maps give you an idea of the shape of the molecule. And from that even, you can identify that there are 3 domains to the molecule. And what we did was, using these electron density maps, we fit the molecule by 3 ellipsoids, 3 interpenetrating ellipsoids. And there's our model. So from that, we got a model of the molecule. And then we noticed some things. So I'm discussing this tail sheath, and we set up a coordinate system. And we noticed some things about that tail sheath. For example, on the first annulus, there's the first annulus that's attached to the base plate. There are 6 molecules. And using our model of the molecule, there are 3 of the molecules. So you can see 1, 2, 3, and then there's 4, 5, 6 arranged in this kind of regular way. And if you begin at this molecule, and instead of going around the first annulus, you now go up the main helix. So the main helix is this helix pictured right here. We call that the main helix. And you plot the molecules. Again, we're looking down along the axis of the tail sheath. So there's molecule one. That's the same molecule as this one. And now instead of going around the annulus, we go up the main helix, and you can see the molecules change in a regular way as you go up that helix. So you could imagine that with this kind of... In fact, the interesting thing, or one interesting thing, is that the eighth molecule on this helix is directly over the third molecule on the annulus. That teaches you something about how this is built, and there's some other things you can figure out, and you can use this notation for a rotation matrix with angle theta and axis E3. So we use this coordinate system, and you can imagine you can write a formula with that kind of information. You could write a formula for the position of the center of mass and the orientation of every molecule on the tail sheath. So we did that, and that's the formula we got. So let me explain the formula. So first of all, there are 6 times 23 molecules on the tail sheath. 6 molecules on the annulus, first annulus, and there are 23 annuli. And that's true of both the extended and the contracted form. In fact, this formula works for either one. These pictures were generated with this formula. And so what's in the formula? So there's some rotation matrices, Q hat and Q. They're raised to certain powers. That just means you multiply the rotation matrix by itself, matrix multiplication by L times and so forth. R is a rotation matrix which tells you the orientation of the first molecule. So if you know how the first molecule is oriented, you know how every molecule is oriented. And now the notation. So ij is just, I'm just using a double index for the molecule. So we talk about the ijth molecule. I goes from 1 to 6, j goes from 1 to 23. And yij, given by this formula, is the position of the center of mass of each molecule, of each of the ij molecules. And rij is the orientation. It's a rotation matrix which takes you from the first molecule to any other molecule, to the ijth molecule. And this, the orientation is given by this formula. So you get this just by looking at those helices. But it's got an interesting structure, and these formulas intrigued me, and this is what got me in the direction I'll be speaking. But of course, they're parameters. Y0 is given by a certain formula. Rho is basically the radius. Lambda is the pitch of the main helix. And gamma is an angle in this Q, which has to do with the placement of the molecules along the main helix. This formula works for both the extended and contracted form. Okay, so that's the position of the center of mass and the orientation of every molecule on tail sheath. And I looked at those formulas, and I noticed there's something incredibly interesting about this structure. Okay? And so I want to explain what it is. It's a property of those formulas, but if you look more carefully, it's a property actually of those, at least approximately, of those electron density maps. And now, after some work, we believe it's a property of every single atom in the structure. So the property is this. Imagine you go to, so this had a certain number of molecules. Go to one of the molecules, okay? And each of those molecules has a certain number of atoms. It actually has, as I said, in this case, quite a large number. There are 10,000 atoms per molecule or so. So go to one of the atoms. Go to the 100th atom of one of the molecules. Okay, and imagine you're sitting on the 100th atom of molecule IJ. And look around. So nearby, you see other atoms of the same molecule. And further away, you see the other atoms of the other molecules. Now go to the 100th atom of a different molecule. So go somewhere else in the tail sheath. Go to a 100th atom of a different molecule. Sit on it. Look at your environment. Reorient yourself in a certain way. And you see exactly the same environment. In fact, if I extended the tail sheath out to infinity by using the same formulas but not restricting J to go from from 1 to 23, it could go from minus infinity to plus infinity. That would draw me an infinite tail sheath. Then it would have precisely this property. So I thought that was quite an interesting property for a structure to have. And I decided to study that property. So the way you do that is you first need to write that property down mathematically. And here it is. It's very easy to do this. So of course the first thing we do is we change notation. So now the notation has changed. Now ij is not an index for the molecule, but I'm going to just use I for the molecule. Okay. So I goes from 1 to n. There are n molecules. And actually typically in this talk, n will be infinite. There's going to be infinite number of molecules because these structures often go off to infinity. And then, but within each molecule, there's a certain number of atoms, m atoms. So j goes from 1 to m. So we have xij, that's the position vector of atom j within molecule I. Okay, that's the notation. And I call it an objective molecular structure. And I'll explain a little bit why I use that terminology. If there are rotation matrices, actually they can be orthogonal matrices. So the determinant can be plus or minus 1. One for each atom. So R1, 1 to RNM, such that this formula gives you back the same structure for any choice of I and K. So what is this formula? So this formula is just what, in mathematical terms, what I said in words. You look at the nmth molecule of the structure from the point of view of molecule K, atom K of molecule 1. So you sit on atom K of molecule 1 and you look at the whole structure. By looking at the whole structure, we look at the relative position vectors from that. And then you reorient yourself and you add that to atom K of molecule I and you get exactly the same structure back again. That's just a way to say that mathematically. It says that corresponding atoms in each molecule see the same environment. And of course, the simplest case is when you only have one atom per molecule, m is 1, then you could forget the second index here, and you can call that an objective atomic structure. That's a structure composed of like atoms, where every atom sees exactly the same environment up to orthogonal transformation. Okay, there's some things mathematically you can do here. Another way to write this definition is write the same left-hand side. That has to restore the structure, so there must be a permutation of n and m, of the indices n and m, so that the right-hand side can be written this way. And so this just cycles through all the indices of the structure. So nothing... You can study this definition, and basically that's all. Everything that I've said so far is all embodied in that definition. There's nothing else that's needed, except for one thing, is that when you look at the structure from the point of view of atom K of molecule 1, you may look out there and you may see an atom, and I haven't said anything about whether that atom is carbon or nitrogen or oxygen or whatever. And in reality, we're interested in the case where it actually has a certain species. And when you look at that atom from one of the view of K of molecule 1, it has a certain species. When you look at the equivalent atom from atom K of a different molecule, you would want to have the same species. Okay, so that's... And so a way to say this is this permutation preserves species. If pi, the permutation of n and m on indices n and m are p and q, then the species of q is the same as the species of m. And that just represents species. And only discrete structures are of interest. You know, you can actually make many non-discrete structures. In other words, in a finite volume, you only want a finite number of atoms. Okay, so let me just begin by giving some examples of these structures so you get an idea. Now, of course, crystals are structures like this, right? And the simplest crystal is a Bravais lattice. You take three vectors, E1, E2, and E3, that are linearly independent, and you take integers on those. Take three vectors with integers, and that generates you a lattice. And, of course, That's an objective atomic structure. Each atom sees exactly the same environment. In fact, to get the environment of one atom to another, you just translate to that. You use the translation, which takes you from atom 000 to that atom. Or if you want, you can directly verify the definition. Integers on three linearly independent vectors can be written as fixed integers plus some other integers on those vectors, and therefore can be written this way. But this is really the definition. If you look at this form, you put this equal to the identity matrix. You take the atom 1 as being atom 0, 0, 0. In other words, new 1, new 2, new 3, all 0. And this is just the left-hand side of this formula. So it's and it generates the same structure. You could write the permutation in this case. A multilattice, so that's a more complicated periodic structure, but you know, any time we talk about a crystal like this crystal, nickel 2 manganese gallium, that's also an objective structure. It's an objective molecular structure. And you should think of the molecule in this case as the collection of atoms within the unit cell. And then the definition works. And again, you do a little calculation here, and you verify the definition. And again, the reorientation matrices in this case are all the identity matrix. And it's pretty clear that in this picture, the green atoms all see exactly the same environment. And the blue atoms, they see a different environment, but each blue atom sees exactly the same environment. Okay, bacteriophage T4 tail sheath. So far, I only told you the position of the center of mass, yij, and the orientation of each of molecule ij. Now I'm reverting to the old notation, sorry. But now I want to tell you where every single atom is, all 10,000 atoms, and it's very easy to do. You just take the original formulas, and now the molecules indexed by ij, the atom within the molecules indexed by k, and you just do this. If you do this formula, I claim it gives you every single position of every single atom on T4 tail sheath. And it works for both extended and contracted forms. Here's another example. Of course, you can imagine if you just geometrically, you can think again like Buckminster Fuller, and you can look at an icosahedron. And of course, there are the atomic structure of a buckyball is an icosahedron, just like this, with carbon atoms at each of those points. And if you think about that, and even this coloring can help you a little bit, if you sit on any one of these atoms, you see a certain environment, but in fact it's exactly the same environment for every single atom on that structure. And again, it's very easy to show it verifies the definition. If you let Q1 to Q60 be the 60 rotation matrices, you can easily write them down in MATLAB, that form the icosahedral group, and you make this formula. Now I'm going to do it for not for one atom per molecule, but for an arbitrary number of atoms per molecule. And so I pictured an example here. Then, and they have position vectors P1 to PM. Then you use this formula. So now I've reverted to the old notation, or the second notation. J is the index for the atom, and I is an index for the molecule. There are 60 molecules. You choose the reorientation matrix, in fact, to be the QIs, and then a simple calculation tells you that restores exactly the structure. Corresponding atoms see exactly the same environment. And viruses, the capsids of almost all viruses satisfy that condition. They're given by exactly such a formula with appropriate choices of those PJs. Here's an example that teaches you maybe you kind of would like to be open-minded about the choice of the molecule. So in this case, I want to choose my molecule as a sheet of atoms. In fact, they don't even have to be a sheet, but it's convenient to do that. And if I were solving equilibrium equations, it might be even more convenient to do that. But the sheet could be distorted in any way. In fact, I could put those atoms anywhere I want, and what I say is true. And now I apply this formula, which is similar to the previous formulas. Now the atoms are indexed by ij because I have a 5 by 5 sheet. And K is the index per molecule. The whole cross-section is a molecule. And apply this formula. So now, for this formula to give me an objective structure, E3 has to be a unit vector. It has to be on the axis of this Q. This is Q raised to a certain power. The angle can be anything. And these are assignable, as I just said. And K is an integer. So just apply that formula to this sheet of atoms. If I make the E3 more or less perpendicular to the sheet, I get a picture that looks like B. It kind of looks like torsion. If I take an axis which comes out at you and apply it to the same molecule, I get something that looks like bending. And if I put the axis in some crazy direction, I get something that looks like this. But again, you can see that this is an objective molecular structure. In other words, this atom sees precisely the same environment as that atom. And I think it's a useful way to think about many of the kind of nanostructures that you would see being synthesized these days is in terms like this. Well, I'll talk more about it later, why they might like to do this. So here's another observation. Let's look at the periodic table of the elements. Okay? And now each element has some favorite crystal structure. That's what you can read on the crystal structures of the elements. Some of the elements don't like to be crystals. They make other things. But anyway, everything is known. Of course, if we know that copper is face-centered cubic crystal, but we know also you can take a copper crystal and smash it with a hammer and it's nothing. You know, it doesn't have any particular structure. So when I say this, I'm talking about the common structures of the elements, what you would read in a typical textbook. So here's an interesting thing to do. Most people think about the crystal structures, the elements in terms of crystal structures. In fact, I got this up the web, and it was cubic and hexagonal and so forth. So, and the natural the building blocks of crystals are Bravais lattices. So as I said before, you take three linearly independent vectors, and you take integers on those vectors, and that by definition is a Bravais lattice. So FCC, the face-centered cubic crystal structure of copper, is a Bravais lattice, and you could take the E1, E2, E3 to be those three vectors, and that definition will give you FCC. So now an interesting thing to do is to go to the periodic table and ask what elements crystallize in Bravais lattices like copper. So I did that. So it's the same periodic table, but what I did is I blacked out the ones that do not form Bravais lattices. So you can see, you know, only about half the elements in the periodic table form Bravais lattices. And again, copper is there, of course nickel is there, both face-centered cubic, and so these are body-centered cubic, and so forth. So, of course, many of the black spots are explained by the fact that the elements, some of those elements like to be in the hexagonal close-packed structure. And hexagonal close-packed is not a Bravais lattice. Okay, so that's one. Explains a number, but it only explains another maybe 20 or 30% of those points. So now the interesting thing to do is to go back to the periodic table. Now, in the periodic table, we're just dealing with elements. So it's an interesting thing to ask, of the common crystal structures, or the common structures of elements, which ones form objective atomic structures? Okay? So we do that. So which ones satisfy this definition? Or in other words, there's an example of a non-crystalline objective atomic structure, just a ring of atoms. Every atom sees the same environment. And you get an amazing thing. So almost all the elements, their natural structures are objective atomic structures. Not Bravais lattices, but objective atomic structures. There's one counterexample, manganese. Manganese is not an objective atomic structure, but it's the only counterexample except for ones which don't have any structure people don't know what the structure really is. And I don't have the rare earths down here, but almost all the rare earths are hexagonal close packed and would favor this argument. Hexagonal close-packed, by the way, is an objective atomic structure, even though it's not a Bravais lattice. Every atom sees exactly the same environment in a HCP lattice. So, and there's also interesting is some of them are, of course, don't like periodic structures. So boron makes icosahedra. This is an objective atomic structure. Carbon is a very flexible element. It makes carbon nanotubes. That's a very simple kind of carbon nanotube, but there are many different carbon nanotubes with many different chiralities. Every one of them is an objective atomic structure. Of course, the graphite lattices, buckyballs, which are named after that former University of Minnesota professor, Buckminster Fuller. The diamond lattice made with carbon is also an objective atomic structure. Some other elements form diamond lattices too. Sulfur forms little rings like this. Those are objective atomic structures. And these elements, fluorine, chlorine, bromine, and iodine, form kind of layered structures, which are also satisfy that definition. So it intrigued me, why do the elements like those objective atomic structures? And in addition, we see those kind of structures in viruses and many other places. And so it seems like an interesting kind of structure to study. And now I want to say a few words about why they might be so common, or what are the special properties with regard to, what are the special physical properties which would favor these structures. So from that point of view, you have to look at a model for the way molecules interact with each other, and the most basic one is actually probably the most, you know, the gold standard of such models is this version of quantum mechanics. So I should say that we think in this department more and more in terms of models like this rather than the continuum models that we thought about for many years, and we think because of we're asking questions that like the ones I've been asking, we think more in terms of these models. So we minimize, but it's, you might think of it as some kind of elastic energy in a sense. You minimize some functional, which is very explicit. There's no material constants in here. That's a great thing for us, isn't it? And everything is fundamental. You minimize it over anti-symmetric normalized wave functions, and you get something which depends on a number of variables. I've done it in the atomic case that all the atoms have the same species. And in fact, it becomes the minimum energy is parameterized by the positions of the nuclei. That's what the X1 to XNs are. And so if you know the positions of the nuclei, then you minimize this and you get the potential energy of the system. That's the phi. So that's quantum mechanics. And if you look at this functional and you play around a while, you see that it has a kind of invariances. One is it's invariant under rotations and translations. That's expected, of course. And the other is it's invariant under permutations of atoms with like species. But you can see that those two invariances somehow are built directly into the definition of an objective structure. So objective structures interact with this energy in a very good way. If you have an objective molecular structure, so different types of atoms, you have an equivalent result, and the invariance is a little more complicated to write down, but it interacts with the definition of an objective molecular structure in a very good way. I don't need to explain that. But here's how it can interact in a good way. So this phi is the potential energy. So we're taking the atomic case. It's that potential energy given after you minimize by this complicated expression. But anyway, just by calculation, if you have an objective atomic structure, you can see that minus d phi d xi, that's the force on atom I, is rotation Ri times d phi dx1, where the Ri is the reorientation matrix that appears in the definition of an objective atomic structure. In other words, if one atom is in equilibrium, like d phi dx1 is zero, then all atoms are in equilibrium. So that's the kind of property which would make it very easy for these structures to satisfy equilibrium. Now, objective structures have free parameters. Like in the bacteriophage T4 tail sheath, we have this lambda parameter, I had the radius, I had several, three parameters, in fact, for T4 tail sheath. And all the objective structures I mentioned, there are several parameters, three parameters. So the positions are actually parameterized by certain parameters. As you change those parameters, you still get an objective structure, but you might think it deforms. So you can say it deforms. If you take the potential energy and evaluate at the positions of an atomic structure, of an objective atomic structure, they're themselves functions of these structural parameters, and you get a potential energy which is a function only of the structural parameters. There could be many, many positions of the structure, but these parameters, there might be only a few. In fact, generically, there's three. And so you can have a notion of structural equilibrium that says the structure is in equilibrium with respect to variations of these parameters, be a small number of parameters. And just by simple chain rule calculation, it's given by this. It's given by d phi dx1 times something which is purely geometric, has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. It's only about the way the structure is built. And if you had structural equilibrium, this would be zero. And if this was rich enough to contain three linearly independent vectors, and its dot product with this was zero, it would mean that d phi dx1 would be zero. Atom 1 would be in equilibrium, but then you see that every atom would be in equilibrium. So structural equilibrium for objective atomic structures implies that every single atom is in equilibrium. So that's a very powerful reason why atoms might want to form such structures. And I'll tell you later how you can calculate this potential energy in a very simple way. Okay, so but for now, I want to say a few words about. So last year I was on sabbatical, and one thing I did was I calculated together with Ryan Elliott and Kaushik Dial. We calculated a formula for every single objective molecular structure. It's a tremendous calculation. In fact, I myself, not including those guys, I myself spent more than 1,000 hours on this calculation. So I'll tell you the result of this calculation. The way to think of it is in terms of isometries. So you use this notation, rotation translation. This could be, in fact, orthogonal matrix. So there's a 3x3 orthogonal matrix, and there's a translation vector. And you can write these isometries. If you take the product of two isometries, you use this rule. So that rule looks a little strange. The reason for that, it just corresponds to composition of mappings. An isometry on X is Rx plus C. And if you take an isometry on X and take another isometry on top of that, in other words, you substitute for the X, say G2 of X, then you see that this is the product rule you get. So about just composition. If you iterate one of those, so if you raise it to a certain power, G1 of G1 of G1 of G1 of X, you just get this formula by simple calculations. And if you iterate, here I iterated three of them, and I wrote a formula. Now you can see that this formula is looking a lot like the formula I had for T4 tail sheath. In fact, if you took two of these, so put G3 equal to the identity, which is identity matrix 0, then you'll get exactly the formula for T4 tail sheath. So these isometries are closely related to the objective structures. And so here's the... Okay, I won't tell you all the formulas, although actually I could tell you all the formulas. I mean, the point is that this condenses a huge part of the international tables of crystallography, in our view, down to several simple formulas. And the formulas all have the following structure. So a way to say that is after careful renumbering of atoms. So you have to be very careful about how you number the atoms. And if you're given an objective structure, there's a careful procedure of renumbering the atoms. And you have to allow molecules to overlap in order to have the simple formulas. But if you do those two things, then every objective molecular structure can be written as products of these isometries on the positions of the atoms within molecule 1. And you only need to use 5 of these isometries. We can tell you exactly what they are. We can tell you the parameters they depend on, everything about them. So it's very useful. Basically, we can construct all objective molecular structures. So I will... So in fact, bacteriophage T4 tail sheath, I already talked about how you get all the atoms for that. That's to make the connection between that and this formula. In fact, that formula is exactly is exactly the product of two of these isometries on these 10,000 positions. And those isometries happen to commute, and that's, in fact, the experimental values of these parameters satisfy this. That means they commute, and that means that this gives the formula. So it's quite easy to generate these formulas. So, for example, here's an example. I'll take the so-called three-term formula. That's this formula. And to be an objective molecular structure, the G1, G2, G3 have to satisfy these conditions. They have to commute, basically. Or that's one example. If they commute, this gives an objective molecular structure. And it means that there's some conditions between these R's and T's. And you can just easily solve these conditions and find all the structures. So I'll show you some of the structures generated by the three-term formula with commuting. We would call this the three-term abelian formula. There's the molecules. So even though P, Q, and R, they index the molecule, they go from minus infinity to plus infinity, sometimes the molecules keep falling on top of each other. And so, in fact, you can get some finite cases even out of that formula. So there's a four-term, there's a four-molecule structure which satisfies the conditions. Those are the R's and T's which give it. There's an eight molecule structure, which is an objective molecular structure. In all these cases, I'm using a kind of blob, a kind of unsymmetric blob, to represent the molecule. So since the P1 to PM can be any position vectors, you could use any blob you want. It's not about the molecule shape, it's about the relationships between the molecules. And that the formula also gives rings, single rings. It also gives double rings. This is a case where they're unstaggered, and that also gives a staggered case. Of course, you could never have an objective molecular structure which was a triple ring, because then the middle ring would be distinguished, right? So it's, the point is, corresponding atoms see exactly the same environment. There's bilayers. They come out in a very natural way of that formula. So this is these are unstaggered bilayers. There's also a staggered version of these bilayers. There's some kind of fibrous things that come out, which are not helical, but still sort of like fibers. There's a staggered version, unstaggered version. And if you go to, interesting thing is to go to a typical undergraduate textbook on protein structure and start paging through and look at the sort of most common structures in biology, you'll see that quite a few of them are objective molecular structures. So maybe 10% of the pages in this book are objective molecular structures of different kinds, and even 20% are sort of approximate objective molecular structures. So, for example, on page 101, this is the very important, the cover has one. That's the potassium channel. And this is the so-called GRO-EL protein. It's a protein which helps other proteins fold. It's one of the most important proteins. And this is a cross-section through it. Well, this is a cross-section. And this is a representation of the molecule. The molecule has three domains. And you can see, by looking at that, that that's, in fact, an unstaggered objective molecular structure as a ring. So that's they're quite common, especially as the most basic molecules of biology. So now I want to finish my talk. Okay, this is perfect, working out perfectly with time, with several applications of these ideas. So they have some interesting applications with regard to computations of energy and dynamics of structures. Okay, so I want to explain that a little bit. So, as you can hear in the news or go to the physics department, there's a lot of calculations of quantum mechanics calculations on crystals these days. In fact, the fact that density functional theory is so prominently used to explain the properties of crystals, particularly electromagnetic properties these days, is because of one fact. It was because of density functional theory, first of all, which is a simplification of quantum mechanics. Due to Walter Cohen, it received the Nobel Prize. But it's really a second fact which makes it usable, and that is that you can do a computation on a small unit cell. the unit cell of the crystal and use periodic boundary conditions, and that will give you an equilibrium state for density functional theory for the entire structure. In other words, periodic boundary conditions are the right boundary conditions for density functional theory. And because of the fact that you can do a computation with just a small unit cell, you can do this on crystal lattices, and you can discover many properties of materials and design materials even with these ideas. So everything works for objective structures. Everything is exactly the same. The only thing is you have to replace periodic boundary conditions by what we call objective boundary conditions. You can, if you had a structure like this, and this was your molecule, I'm not doing this in a very schematic way now, you would put the density, the electronic density at this point equal to the electronic density at that point. And you would put the electronic density there equal to the electronic density there. Just what you might expect looking at the symmetry of the structure. Or the actual condition on the density in terms of the matrices I used is this condition. And if you use those kind of boundary conditions and solve on a small unit cell, then you've solved equilibrium for the whole structure according to quantum mechanics. Now let me tell you that so you have a simple calculation on a small unit cell to determine the energy of a structure. And now suppose. Now, earlier I said that we have those structural parameters. Those are the parameters we can vary, keeping the structure an objective structure. We can deform the structure by changing those parameters. Suppose you do this computation that I've described here for every value of the structural parameters, and you get a surface. That's a reasonably small computation, and you find a minimum of that, and that means that you have structural equilibrium. But then, according to what I said earlier, you deduce from that every single atom is in equilibrium in the structure. So it's very easy to do. It's as easy as people do for crystals to do quantum mechanics calculations on objective structures. But this has a physical implication, an interesting physical implication. It means the following. When you do a quantum mechanics calculation on a small unit cell, there's things you can determine about the behavior of the material from what's going on in that unit cell. One thing you can look at is unpaired spins. Once you calculate the electronic structure, that's a subroutine you do. You calculate whether there's unpaired spins. If there's unpaired spins, that atom you might say is magnetic. If you look at that calculation, it's a Feynman different calculation, which means that if one atom is magnetic in one of these structures, every atom is magnetic in one of these structures. In other words, the structure exhibits ferromagnetism. That's a collective property. You need lots of atoms adding up to give you that property. So these are, and similarly, ferroelectricity and even transport properties are superconductivity. So these are the natural structures for which to look for these interesting properties like ferromagnetism, ferroelectricity, and interesting transport properties. So we're beginning to do this, especially with Trion Dimitrica. Another thing we're doing with Trion Dimitrica, so I should mention, is here's an interesting thing. So if you go to a molecular dynamics code, okay, and you download it and you begin using it, it always uses this kind of molecular dynamics, even if it does not appear to. And it's explained this way. It's called periodic molecular dynamics. Okay, so you only need to simulate the atoms in this unit cell. You pick a cell. You only need to simulate the atoms in this cell. Okay, so you solve molecular dynamics is F equals ma for atoms. You solve F equals ma for each atom in these cells, in the cell, and they move around, and they may pass in and out of the cell. It doesn't matter. And for every atom in that cell, it has a force on it from all the other atoms. Usually there's a cutoff, so all the other atoms within a cutoff. You calculate the force on this atom using all the other atoms, okay? Now but the atoms in the other unit cells, you do not solve F equals ma, okay? What you do with the other atoms in the unit cells is you force them, if this atom is in this position and this atom undergoes a certain displacement, you force this atom to undergo exactly the same displacement. And so forth for all the atoms. So all the other atoms in the unit cells are determined by periodicity. Positions are determined by periodicity. So you could say, it's not a real solution of molecular dynamics, because I didn't solve F equals ma for this atom. I forced it to go somewhere, okay? But it is an exact solution of molecular dynamics. If you started initial data that had this periodicity with any positions and velocities, and you exactly solve molecular dynamics, this atom would go with exactly this displacement. And that's periodic molecular dynamics. And the proof of that is very simple, and you use exactly the invariants we've been discussing. So, once again, everything is true with objective structures. So take a carbon nanotube, and you take a certain fundamental domain. Here's one example. And you solve molecular dynamics on this fundamental domain with forces on this atom, on every atom, from all the other atoms. But atoms outside the fundamental domain, you force to go to certain locations, not by periodicity, but by using the natural structure of objective structures. So there's a formula for where every other atom goes, explicit formula. You solve that, you have an exact solution of molecular dynamics. So it's really fun to play with this. And we did this with carbon nanotubes with Triandometrica. So this is an example of a carbon nanotube. We only simulated those gray atoms. And all the other pictures I'll show you, the domain of simulation is only a very small domain, like less than 100 atoms in every case. And what we did, by controlling those structural parameters, we twisted a carbon nanotube. And at first it twisted uniformly, but when we reached about 3 degrees per angstrom, we got a wonderful instability which looked like this. And we could nicely define the instability. And we could see that there is a dependence on the choice of the fundamental domain. So sometimes we would get bifurcations with different modes. We looked at the energy of these, and we could figure out the minimum energy one. In fact, all the bifurcation points were nearly the same here, around a little more than 2 degrees per nanometer. So it's a very nice method of simulation. One has to be aware that there may be a dependence on the fundamental domain. And it also allows you, by changing the structural parameters, to twist the carbon nanotube. So there's a whole bunch of questions about this method, and what's it really doing, and how do you define the forces, and many things. But I hope this gives a little flavor. Oh, and here's an example using a different formula for objective structures, where we did bending. And we again reached some point where there was an instability. Actually, these things on carbon nanotubes, even though it's composed of atoms, they're very continuum-like. It looks like even better in a way, it looks like a kind of very idealized shell, and seems to deform and act in very much like a shell with kind of bifurcations and instabilities. So Perry's looking at me, I can tell you. So I think actually I'll stop there. It's a good place to stop.
Everybody was looking at you.
But you were looking at me in a special way.
I was wondering when you were going to do lipid crystals.
Okay.
Other questions? So that buckled carbon nanotube at the end, the last slide or so?
Yeah.
That's still an objective structure then, in that buckled position?
Yes, it is. Okay. So you now, the way you